Good evening, everybody. Good evening, everybody. Hal learned this in the church. If you don't get the response the first time, you do it the second time, right? That's right. Okay. I'm going to test something real quick here. It works. Okay. My name is Tim Kelly, and many of you know me. Some of you may not. I used to be in these parts some time back. I want to introduce my wife, Angie, back here, for those of you who don't know her. We've been married 40-something years now, and we met just right down the road here at the Field House 42 years ago. I also want to introduce my fellowship, our fellowship. Angie and I started the Ami Israel Fellowship in 2005. We meet in Longview, in a church there in Longview, and many of our fellowship is here. Why don't you guys all stand up? Come on, don't be bashful. All right, so this is some of our fellowship, and they came out today. We canceled services today, and they chose to come out and listen to me again. I tell you what, dedicated group of people. Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of information about why we're called Ami Israel. Ami Israel is the most often used term for the people of God in the Bible. If you go search it out, you can get your Strong's, and if you can take in, or if you've got a computer and you can take and do two words at a time, and they're, you know, two consecutive terms, look up my people, and the most oftentimes you'll, or if you look up my people, you'll see that compared to any other term that's used for the people of God, Ami Israel is the term. Ami Israel means my people Israel. And so God calls himself, says, I am Yahweh, I'm the God of Father, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and stuff. And he'll talk about my people Israel. So that's what we are. Okay, let me see. One other thing I wanted to share with you is that we've got a small prison ministry. My wife and I started about 2013, I think it was. We teach a Hebrew Roots group down in Lufkin, Texas. And it's a good little prison group there. It's a small prison. We've got anywhere from 10 to 20 people, 25 people sometimes. Guys come there for that. It's a very lively group of people. Many of the original guys are still there with it. The ones that are not there have been shipped out or have been released. And so we have a good time down there with those guys. I have the blessing of having a two-hour time slot. Most prison ministries only last for about an hour in Texas prisons. And the chaplain has been gracious enough to give me 2 hours since I drive 2 hours and 15 minutes to get there. So it was good. Okay, well, to get started here, I just want to let you guys know that I'm in a cult. And guess what? You are too. Okay. I appreciate Donna bringing up that little topic there, little answer to that. The word cult is an interesting term, interesting word. But the word comes from a Latin word that means to cultivate. And so I think that we have all been sent out to cultivate people, haven't we? Aren't we supposed to be planting seeds and watering the seeds and stuff like that? Well, I think that's what God has called us to do and sent us out to do. And so I believe that that is what we are supposed to be doing. And as we go on through this message, I want to explain to you why I believe that we are in a cult, what is our job as part of a cult, and how being a part of this cult is going to further the work of God. Okay, so I didn't go to Ambassador College, but I went to Spokesman's Club. And in Spokesman's Club, they tell you to say what you're going to say it, and then tell what you told them, right? Yes, okay, so that's what I'm going to do. That's my plan. I'm going to talk a little bit about our background, or my background specifically. I'm going to talk about what is Hebrew Roots, its early history, the foundation of Hebrew Roots, its recent history, what we believe and teach, and then I'll summarize everything past that point. So let's start off with a little bit about who I am. I was raised in a Torah pursuant home. My parents both in about 1965 began walking in this walk. I remember, as I was sharing last night, I remember when we officially got into it, because it was Christmas Day, and we were opening our presents, and my dad came in and said, "Okay, kids, y'all enjoy it." I got four brothers and a sister. He said, "Kids, y'all enjoy it. It's your last Christmas." And so we were introduced to this walk that way. But my dad was not able to go to church for a number of years, and so I didn't get to go to church very often. And well, I didn't for actually about 4 years. And so here I was about 14, 15 years old. And my dad said, he wouldn't let us go out and do anything on the Sabbath, but he would say, "Go study your Bible." Well, at 15 years old, not too interested in the Bible. But I was interested in something that I saw that my dad had brought home one time. And it was this book called The United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy. And so I read that book. And I read that book, and I read that book, and I probably read that book 10, 15 times, because it was very interesting to me what was said in that book. And so it made an impact on me. And, you know, I believed what I was reading, because it seemed to make sense, and I did a little bit of history, searching back then in the libraries and stuff to see if any of this stuff was true. And it did seem like some of this stuff was true. And so I believed it. All right. So that was early. I kept my first Pentecost on a Monday in 1967. Some of you remember that. And then in 1969 was my first Feast of Tabernacles. And so this past feast we have attended 50... I had attended 50 Feast of Tabernacles. One other thing about us, Angie and I got married in 1969. We did the church thing here, and we only were here, you know, in the big Sandy area. Many of you know that. And so, as many of us are, there's such a big church, you could get lost in the crowd. And we were often lost in the crowd, but I tended to hang around with some of the guys that I met in Spokesman's Club who were also part of the Buildings and Grounds, since I was sort of in Buildings and Grounds too. And so we would talk and talk and talk. And I was a cynic. Some of you would never believe that. But I was a cynic. I did not necessarily take in everything that was told to us or taught to us. And I sort of like to search things out. And so in 1997, Angie and I basically walked away from the Church of God and got into other things. And in the 1997, 1998, we took and hosted some meetings. We call them Footsteps of the Messiah meetings. It was during that time that I met a guy who was very influential to me, and his name was Dean Wheelock, and another guy was Joe Good. And it just so happens it was through Dean Wheelock's Hebrew Roots magazine that was it's made its way through most of the prisons in Texas. Is that how they got hold of me? Because I'd written an article that Dean published, and so they found out that there was someone, Hebrew Roots, in Texas, and so they got their chaplain to call me, see if I would do it. And I was totally against prison ministries at the time, but I ended up doing it anyway. So, try to get into more of this. I guess I got some extra time. He told me he didn't tell me how much, so I'm just going to take advantage of everything I can get. In the breakup of the Worldwide Church of God, we took and caused me to have to study my Bible. And I had not studied my Bible much. I was a backseat Christian. I threw my Bible in the back of my truck or my car right after services every day or every Sabbath. And then I usually didn't get hold of it again until the next Sabbath. And so everything I learned was through osmosis. And so I came to accept everything, though I did have questions about a number of things. And one of those things was tithing. And so when I got into, when we left, one of the things I had been studying, and I started studying more earnestly, was the concept of tithing and where did it actually come from? And I read a number of articles from various people who had left the church and who I knew that were a little bit confused or at least didn't agree with the thing about tithing. But what I found, though, was I was studying this Encyclopedia Judaica. In the Encyclopedia Judaica, because I was just trying to find information about tithing, and basically I found out that everything that Mr. Armstrong taught about tithing was in the Encyclopedia Judaica. That is what the Jews taught about tithing. The only difference is that the Jews would say, we can't do it because there's no one to take to serve as Levites anymore. So the Jews don't tithe today, but they did teach that they understood the concept of tithing like Mr. Armstrong did. Another thing I found out was that I started studying the calendar a little bit and come to find out that what we used to call God's sacred calendar was nothing but the traditional Jewish Hillel calendar. It's the same thing. No difference. It's a traditional calendar. We're keeping Jewish tradition when we keep God's sacred calendar. And so that was somewhat interesting to me as well. And then another thing, I always wondered why we sang a song, "Oh, give thanks and praise the Eternal, call upon His sacred name," but we would not call Him by His sacred name. And so that was another thing that I sort of studied out as well. So anyway, as a result of my studies and some of the things I'd come up with, I came to think that I was a part of something called Jewish Roots. And so Angie and I one day packed up our kids. We went up to Dallas to a Messianic synagogue up there. It's called Baruch Hashem. And we all walked in there with our suits on. My boys had their suits on. Wife dressed up really, really nice. We walked in there, and of course we had our briefcase. Had to have your briefcase. Had all your Bibles and everything in it. And we went into this Jewish synagogue and sat down there, and boy, we just loved it. Music was awesome. People were dancing. It seemed like it was so inspiring. And right after the service, I was just elated. And I stood up and I wanted to meet the guy behind me. And I shook his hand and he says, from Worldwide, huh? And I said, how'd you know? He says, you guys all come in with briefcases and ties on. So that was my introduction to Messianic Judaism. So anyway, that's where I came from. But I want to show you basically where we're going. Because like I said, I read the book, United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy, and we were having home fellowships here at my house and down in Lindale at Mitchell Smith's house. Some of you may have known Mitchell Smith. And all of a sudden, one day I came home and someone had mailed me this book. And I know the guy's name now. His name is Mike Steyer. He was part of the Church of God also. He sent me this book from this person that I had never heard of before, and her name was Batya Wooten. And Batya Wooten wrote a book called Who is Israel and Why You Need to Know. And so it's just another book. I really didn't get too excited about it, but I was sort of studying Israel like I'd had as part of my childhood. And I read the book, and I could not put it down. And I think I read the whole book in one sitting. Maybe not, but I just devoured that book. And then I turned around and read it again. It was a very, very interesting book. And what it did is, if any of you had read United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy, you probably remember that Mr. Armstrong tried to identify the peoples of Israel by where they had migrated to and following their path. Well, Batya Wooten took a different approach. She identified the people of Israel by what they did, what their culture was. And as I came to find out, that was really the right way to do it because, you know, in Hebrew, how many of you are familiar with the Hebrew language? Not very many. The Hebrew language is an action language. In Hebrew, In Hebrew, if I wanted to identify, let me say this. In Greek, if I wanted to identify this right here, I would say it's a long, slender thing, silver on one end, black in the middle, and it's got a little button and it pushes back and forth and all that stuff. Okay? In Hebrew, you know how you would identify this? It's something you write with. And so in Hebrew, everything is action-oriented. And so Batya took and she looked at the things that were said in the scripture about what the Israelites were going to do based on prophecy, and she tried to identify those peoples. And she came up with a conclusion that I'm going to share with you as we go along. And it's a very interesting book. Okay, so here I am, part of a cult, at least in the view of many people, that seems to have adopted something called Hebrew Roots. And that's where I'm headed. So let's go here. So what is Hebrew Roots? Hebrew Roots is an awakening. It's an awakening to the Hebrew culture of the Bible. See, the Bible is Hebraic. It's not Greek. We may have gotten our New Testament from the Greeks, but if you look at it, it's very Hebrew in culture. One of the ways you can know that, if you ever go in the Old Testament and you look and you read through the Old Testament, you're going to see how many times it says "and." And I did this, and I did this, and run-on sentences. Go to the New Testament and see the same thing. You'll see all these run-on sentences in the New Testament. But not only is it that, in the New Testament, you see a culture, or there's a culture that you just don't really recognize until you actually begin to understand it's there. Because the New Testament is a book that's full of idioms. It's a book that's full of Hebraic thought. It's a book that's full of Hebraic practices. For instance, there's this phrase that was passed around a lot. It goes like this: "In my Father's house are many mansions." Okay, how many of us were taught that "in my Father's house is many mansions" has something to do with offices of responsibility in the kingdom? Any of you? Okay, put your hands up. Okay, most of you did. I was too. All right? That's a Hebrew wedding custom. Hebrew wedding custom, because when a man and a woman get married, the husband goes off and he builds what's called a huppah. And the huppah is where the father or the husband is going to take his bride for 7 days. That's called his mansion. And it's always built at or in the father's house. So there's these little idioms, cultural things that we just don't see if we don't know that they're there. And unless they're willing to look at the Bible from a Hebraic concept, we're going to miss them. So, Hebrew Roots is an awakening to these things, to the culture of the Bible. We find in the Bible that God, he abhors idolatry. He abhors mixtures of things. He abhors just a whole number of things that if we don't know what we're looking for, we're not going to find them in the Scripture. But the awakening is not just to that. And let me just talk a little bit about how the awakening is taking place. What's happening in Hebrew Roots is that people are just waking up, quite literally waking up, thinking that what they were taught yesterday in church was probably really not right. They're seeing things in the Bible that they just never had seen before. They're not seeing this from listening to radios, or are they seeing this from watching a television program? This is just happening to people. They're just beginning to see stuff that they had never seen before. Unfortunately, what people do when they see these things is they see things that look to them like Jewish. When they see what God's opening their eyes to, like most oftentimes it's to the Sabbath or the holy days, it seems like Passover is a gateway that people want to experience on their way into or out of the church into the Hebrew culture. They see these things as Jewish, and so they start doing Jewish things. They take and they want to go to Passover. They'll go buy a tallit. I bought a tallit. They wear tzitzits, okay? I wear tzitzits. They get shofars. I got shofars. So these are things that people do because they think it's the culture that they're being drawn to is Jewish culture. But that's not the case. They're not being drawn to the Jewish culture. They're being drawn to the Hebrew culture. They just think it's Jewish because that's the only thing they think of that does these things. People don't realize outside of the church or outside of Judaism, people keep Passover. The people keep the Feast of Tabernacles. They don't know that, and so they look at this and they think that they're being drawn toward Judaism. They think they're being drawn to what's called Jewish roots, and I was too. I thought that as well, even though I knew better, because I knew that that there was more than one tribe of Israel, and you know, it just wasn't just the tribe of Judah. But their tribe, you know, they're not Jewish. They're Hebrew. They're being drawn to be part of the olive tree of Israel. They're being drawn to a culture that is Hebraic. And I know I'm going to say this term over and over again, but I want you to realize that the culture is not the Greek culture that we are right now a part of in the churches. The culture is very, very Hebraic. In fact, God's people are Hebraic. God's people are Hebrew. If you go out and just look how many times God looks at his people, he always calls his people Hebrew. The Hebrew people, it's just over and over again, he's identifying his people as Hebrew. And you know what's interesting about it? He identifies his people as being Hebrews when they're good, when they're bad. Doesn't really matter. They're still called by his name. He calls them by his name and refers to them as Hebrews. All right, so I got to move on because I'm only to page two here. If you ever wonder about if you are Hebrew or not, or if your culture is Hebrew, just look at Galatians 3:29 where it says, if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Now, you can take that one of two ways. Does that mean you are Christ because you're already Hebrew? Or does that mean that you are Hebrew because you're already Christ? But either way, you still end up being Hebrew, don't you? Okay, that's the way I read that. All right, so what else is the Hebrew thing here about? When people wake up and begin to realize that they're being pulled toward a Hebraic way, they're also realizing that they're being pulled toward a Hebraic path, a Hebraic walk. So there's more to it than just wearing tzitzits, tallits, and blowing a shofar. It's a walk that's involved with it, and oftentimes that is the deal maker for many people who get involved in Hebrew roots, because once they realize there's a walk associated with it, they're not ready for the walk. And so they generally go back into the church. But Abraham, you know, he was the first Hebrew. God calls him Abraham the Hebrew as he's going to send the angels down to deal with Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he refers to his people again as Hebrews. Moving on here, let's talk a little bit about the Hebrew walk. God says in Scripture, my son, keep your father's commandment and forsake not your mother's teaching. And the Hebrew word there for teaching there is Torah. Bind them on your heart, tie them around your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. And when you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. And so part of the Hebrew walk, the Hebrew way, we might say, is the walk in Torah. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit more as we go on. Another thing that people are seeing when they're being drawn toward the Hebrew roots is that they're seeing that it is a path. It's not paths. It is a path. There is a walk that a person is to follow. Jeremiah 6:16 says, stand you in the ways and see and ask for the old paths of Yahweh and see what is the good way and walk in it, and you shall find purification in your souls. That word paths, I'm pretty sure, I've studied this out before, is a singular word. And you can check it out and see. But there is not a number of ways to God. There is a way. And so what people, as they're getting drawn into this, they're beginning to see that there is a way as well. Another thing that people are coming to see when they get into Hebrew roots is that they're seeing that Yeshua or Jesus, though it's not a wrong term to use, it's a bad transliteration of the Hebrew word Yeshua or the Aramaic word Yeshua. His real name is Yeshua, because Yeshua is a Hebrew word that means salvation. It comes from the Hebrew word Yasha at Strong's 3467. The first place we see the word Yasha used in Scripture is when Moses is saving the daughters of Jethro from the marauding shepherds. And it says, and I think it says in the King James Version that he delivers them from those guys. That word there is Yasha. It's the first place we see the words Yasha there. The second place you see it is at the crossing of the Red Sea, when it says that the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, the waters came in, covered the soldiers, and God saved Israel. And the word there is Yasha. So when the angel comes to Mary and says, name him blank, for he's going to save his people, the angel didn't have to tell her what to name the child. You name the child what the child is supposed to be doing. That's the Hebrew walk. I mean, it's an action. And so he was going to save his people. So she knew to name him Yahshua, even if she had not been told, or actually to her husband. All right. So one last thing about this walk. It says that in 1 John 2, it says, he who says he abides in him, Yeshua, ought himself to also walk just as he walked. And so the walk of God that people are becoming to see as they get into this walk, they're becoming to realize that it's an imitation of the Messiah. They are to be imitating every step he takes. In fact, I did a study and presented a study a couple of years ago on discipleship at the Feast of Tabernacles. And true discipleship means that you take and even try to step in the footsteps of the one that you are taking and following. And so you do everything he did. You don't eliminate anything from what he did if you're going to be a true disciple of his. So that's what the word discipleship means, and that is the implication here when John says you should walk as he walked. You should follow his steps precisely. All right, so when did Hebrew roots begin? Well, we've heard a lot about people, they're tracing their ways back to first century, the quote-unquote church of the first century. I'm going to go a little bit further back. I'm going to go back to Adam and Eve first, because Adam and Eve were given a commission. Their commission was to guard the tree of life. The word for guard there is the word shamar. Shamar is oftentimes translated keep. And so, especially it's translated keep when we see it used in conjunction with the commandments. We are to keep the commandments. Well, the Hebrew word there, shamar, actually means to guard the commandments. So it's our responsibility not only to obey the commandments, but we are to guard the commandments as well. And so the Hebrew walk actually started all the way back in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve being told to guard the tree of life, because it says the Torah, the commandment, is a tree of life. But I'm going to go then up to Jacob. We know how this worked. We've all read the book. Abraham had Isaac. Isaac had Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and Israel had 12 sons. And so, of these 12 sons, there were two predominant sons. One was Judah, and the other one was Joseph. And I'm going to focus here on Joseph, because Joseph had two sons as well. One was called Manasseh, and the other one Ephraim. And as we know how the story goes, Jacob took and adopted Ephraim and Manasseh, because Joseph had become the firstborn, and the firstborn gets a double portion. And so the double portion for Joseph was that two of his sons would become tribes. And so he got twice as much inheritance in the land as did the other brothers of Joseph. And so Ephraim and Manasseh, though, are very important because God put his name on those two guys, on Manasseh and Ephraim, put the name of Israel on them. So they were the ones who were, from that point forward, basically called Israel. And he did another thing for them, too, because he said that not only was his name going to be placed on them, but he said that he was going to, the lads would bless the land. There basically would be a blessing. And the Hebrew word, it's in Genesis 48:16. I haven't got it up there. Genesis 48:16, you see it. And it's interesting because in the Tanakh, where it says they will become a blessing, or they would be a blessing, the the Tanakh, the Hebrew Tanakh, the stone Tanakh, translates that as proliferate like fish. So what he's saying here is that these two guys right here are going to proliferate like fish, which means they're going to grow because fish proliferate, right? Okay, so they're going to grow. It's interesting because we get in the New Testament and we get little hints about what's, and I'm going to start laying some hints on you here. We go in the New Testament, we see Yeshua telling his disciples to do what? Be fishers of men. And so maybe what we're seeing here is that Yeshua is making connection to these guys who were going to proliferate like fish. Now, as the story goes on, Jacob crosses his hands and all that stuff. And so he's telling Joseph, when Joseph objects to what he's doing, he says, I know my son, he also should be a people, speaking of Manasseh, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother Ephraim shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. And this is where things get really interesting. Because the Hebrew words there for multitude of nations is melahagoim. And it literally means fullness of the Gentiles. It doesn't literally mean that they would become a multitude of nations, but it can be translated that way. But the via melahagoim, a fullness of the Gentiles. Well, Paul uses that phrase in Romans chapter 9, I think, where he says that blindness has been on Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. And so we get a little bit more hint about the Hebrew people from that. It's interesting as well because the prophecy given to the two sons of Jacob, or two sons of Joseph, was basically an end-time prophecy. If you look at the prophecies that Jacob gives in that time of his life, they're pretty much all end-time prophecies. And so when we look at Ephraim, who's going to become a multitude of nations or fullness of the Gentiles, in the end time, there's only one nation on the face of the earth that's a multitude of nations. And that's the United States of America. The United States of America, you know, oftentimes we call our nation the United States. Well, it's not. That's not the name of our country. It's the United States of America. Because we are 50 individual nations that are tied together in one union. We're supposedly sovereign nations. But we're the only nation on the face of the earth. Britain is no longer a multitude of nations. There's a few, you know, but their commonwealth has basically fizzled out. And they're... Even Canada and Australia, you know, especially even South Africa, especially is an example that they're really not bowing down to the crown anymore. But we are a sovereign nation. So that might give us a little hint then as to where the Israelites would be at the end time. Okay, now Jacob says one more thing about these sons. It says, so he blesses them that day, saying, by you, Israel will bless. Now, the Jewish people take and they do a blessing for over their children. And they one of their blessings is they call on Rachel, the wife of Joseph. And the other one is on the sons, let my boys be like Ephraim and Manasseh. And so this is... They get that from this, but I think that blessing there means that bless there means more than that. I think it means that the nations are going to be blessed through these two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. And just to get a little bit ahead of the game right now, Ephraim, the word Ephraim comes from a Hebrew word, the Hebrew word parah. Parah, it's a plural word. Ephraim, as parim, basically, is what it would be. Parim means to bear fruit, produce a lot of fruit. And so what God is saying of Ephraim, that he is supposed to produce a lot of fruit. And as it turns out, Ephraim did become the largest of the tribes of the northern tribes. So I want to move on now to the Exodus story, because when we get to the Exodus story, we go up on the mountain, or we go to the mountain there, and God is telling Moses to, you know, keep his people separate from the mountain and all of that. And then he starts to speak, and he says to the people, basically, he actually, I think, does it through Moses. He says, I'll just read it here. I've got it on a slide. "Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Israel was to become a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That was their calling. They were called to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, if you ever study what the priesthood is, we oftentimes think that the priesthood's responsibility was to do sacrifices. That was one of their roles. But their major role was to teach Torah. They were the ones that the people were supposed to go to if they had questions on the Torah. They're the ones who were taken, if there was a problem, the priests were called because they were the ones who knew the Torah. They knew how to handle things because they were the, supposedly the experts on the Torah. Malachi 2, 6 and 7, I'll just reference that. I don't have it up here. But it talks about what's the role of the priest. It's you are to teach the people. You are to teach the people the Torah. And so, basically, Israel being called to be priests means that we are to be teaching Torah. That's our job, to teach Torah. Now, we know the history of Israel, and Israel didn't always follow what they were calling or doing, but just because of their failure does not mean that they are released from the calling. Because Paul says in Romans 11, 29, the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. In the King James Version, it says without repentance. Doesn't make a bit of sense that way. But if you look at any later translation, you'll see that it means that the words there mean that the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. So, what I've laid forth here so far is, I'm sure you've guessed where I'm going. The betrothal of God to Mount Sinai to the children of Israel, by tradition, took place on Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, generally called Pentecost. We don't know for sure, but if you look at the days and everything, you can pretty much say it's right there. And because we know that God tends to do things on time, it would be inappropriate in God's view to not do something monumental like marrying the woman you're going to marry on any day other than a festival day. So it makes a lot of sense to believe that this was what was happening. So let's say that God did indeed then betroth Israel to himself on Pentecost. Then that sort of helps to understand what was happening 1,500 years later, 33 A.D., 34 A.D., 31 A.D., whatever it is, on Pentecost of that day. But we'll get to that here as we go along. But we know that Israel's history, we know that their history was that of basically failure. Only during brief periods of time, like under Joshua, under King David, under King Solomon, only for brief periods of time did Israel truly follow God. Most of the other times they were involved in idolatry. And it's a sad commentary, but that's what happened. And so, according to the Torah, the kingdom was split. Both Israel and Judah became more fully entrenched in idolatry after the kingdom was split. And we know the northern tribes took and put Jeroboam as their leader. And Jeroboam took and started changing the festivals. He moved the times of the festivals. He also set up his own priesthood. He also set up idols in various parts of the country. And so what he did is he basically solidified the people in an idolatrous state. And as a result of that, they fell under the terms of the Torah that would generally be called the curse of the law. Because there's a curse that's found in the Torah in Leviticus chapter 26 and in Deuteronomy chapter 28. that is referenced by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9:11, where he says our people have basically suffering from the curse of the law. Because the curse of the law was that you would be driven out of the land, and then you would be scattered amongst the nations. And so that's exactly what happened. The northern tribe did end up being scattered throughout all of the nations. The southern tribes of Judah did stay in the land for a while, a lot longer, actually, about 300 more years. And then they fell under the Babylonian captivity. But, you know, the southern tribes repented when they were in Babylon. And so God let them come back into the land. But the northern tribes never did. And the northern tribes are still scattered today. They have not been brought back in fullness yet. But nevertheless, Israel still has this unfulfilled calling, and that is to teach Torah to the nations. So Yeshua comes along, pays the penalty for the sins of the repentant people of Israel. He redeemed them from bondage, which is the Passover theme, and they began to return. Now, this time it wasn't Judah that was returning, though. It was the northern tribes, and this is what I'm want to show you as we go on. On Pentecost, and I'll tell you what, I'm doing about 5 hours of teaching in a real short period of time. And so we're having to skip a lot, and we'll just, if you have questions, we'll try to answer those later. But on Pentecost in 31 AD, after Yeshua had died, and the disciples come to him and said, "Will you are you going to restore the temple or restore the kingdom at this time?" And he says, "Well, you guys just wait." So Peter gets up there and gives an awesome message. And as a result, 3,000 people are baptized. And it says that they are added. It doesn't say what they're added to. We assume it says they are added to the church, but it doesn't say that. It just says they were added. And so it says, but the people were beginning to come back. What we're knowing here, what we can see here, is that the people, the Israelites, were beginning to be drawn back. Now, how do I know that? The reason I know that is because I can go to 1 Peter chapter 1, and I would challenge you to do this. Go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and compare the people in 1 Peter chapter 1 that Peter is writing to with the people that attended that Pentecost. And you will find that they were the same nations, almost exactly the same people. And then continue reading on in 1 Peter chapter 1. Actually, 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. And I'm just going to put this up here and read it to you. Peter's saying, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood." I think we heard that before. "A holy nation." I think we heard that before. "A people of his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." That's taken out of Exodus chapter 19. Now, he goes on. "Once you were not a people, lo ami, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, lo ruama in Hebrew, but now you have received mercy." That's quoted almost word for word out of Hosea chapter 1. Hosea chapter 1, and all of the book of Hosea pretty much, is about Ephraim. It's written about Ephraim. Read it. You'll see. The people that Peter was talking to were not Gentiles. The people Peter was talking to were Israelites. Now, why is it called Gentiles? Because the Jews didn't like the northern tribes, the thought of the northern tribes coming back. And so they called them Gentiles. Because Gentile is a, if you use the term Gentile Christian, that is an oxymoron. Because the word Gentile in first century Judah meant a heathen. So if you call yourself a Gentile Christian, you're calling yourself a heathen Christian. Just the way it is, folks. So in Pentecost, the people that were coming back were the northern tribes. Peoples from the northern tribes. Because the prophecies all said that. The prophecies talked about the time the Messiah would return or would come, and he would redeem his people, And the peoples, the people of God would begin to return to the way. The prophecies of return are all over the Old Testament. But they don't apply to the church. The church wouldn't even claim the prophecies of return. You know why? Because mixed in the prophecies of return, almost every one of the prophecies of return starts off with about how bad you are. How you're committing adultery. How you're doing all of these things. The church doesn't want to claim those. They want to claim the return portion of it. But God doesn't do it that way. He talks about your bad, but he says, I know you're going to return. Just read the prophecies of return and you'll see. All right. Another place that we know that the northern tribes are the ones that were being brought back is in Stephen's discourse as he was getting ready to be stoned. And he says, this is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him you shall hear. This is he who was in the church in the wilderness with the angel which spoke to him in the Mount Sinai. What is the church in the wilderness? The church in the wilderness was Israel. The Gentiles weren't there. There was a few of the mixed multitude that were along with them. But the church in the wilderness was Israel. And according to Stephen, he equates that with the people of that day, of his day, that are being a part of the walk, or what we might call the way. So, the church of the first and second century was not something new. It was a restoration of something very old. The church is Israel. It is not spiritual Israel. There is no term in the Bible. The term spiritual Israel does not exist in the Bible. Brad Scott makes this little smart remark sometimes. He says, spiritual Israel is when Israel is spiritual, which didn't happen very many times in their history. So, interesting thought. But, you know, Israel, even in the first century, still had a proclivity to idolatry. Israel always has a proclivity to idolatry. And so as time went on, and as we pick up the stories that other fellows have shared with you already, the church, Israel, makes its way back into idolatry again. Now, let me just stop here for a second and say, not all Israel came back. Only a remnant came back. And so this remnant came back, mixed in with the Jews, which is a very interesting situation right now. I would submit to you that you read the writings of Paul, Peter, James, Galatians, the book of Galatians, they're all about this tribal rivalry between Judah and Israel. And you see it very clearly once you understand what's going on, especially if you're familiar with Messianic Judaism. Because Messianic Judaism, a person who claims to be Israel, or a person who is not Jewish, let's just say it that way, is a second-class citizen. And it was the same way in the first century. You'll find it that way as you study this stuff out. And so we had all these rivals, and Paul was out putting out fires. We had Peter, who was taking in, who would submit to the ways of the Pharisees when the Pharisees were around. But then when they were gone, he would not be that way, because Peter had this problem. He wasn't real committed sometimes. But it was all because in the first century congregations, there was Jewish, there were Pharisees, Christian, let's call them Christian Pharisees, all right? Not a good term, but Christian Pharisees, let's call them. And they were right along there with everybody else. And so the Pharisees, who were part of the quote-unquote first century church, which was actually the church of old, they would try to draw the church toward the traditions more so than simply the Torah. And some of them talked about that already, I think, in this conference. Okay, so the church down through the centuries taught a message about the Messiah, but they tainted the message. The message was not clear about the Messiah. Today, more Bibles are shipped out of the United States of America into other countries than from any group of countries combined. There are more missionaries that go out of the United States, come out of the United States to spread the message of the Messiah than from any other country on the face of the earth. We are the country that gives to more nations, to help them out, give more aid to nations than any other nation on earth. Because we have this, our constitution is based on the Bible. What other nation? Not even Israel has a constitution based on the Bible. Israel is a secular nation. But we are different. Because we are Israel. So I'm going to go now to some recent history. Let you know a little bit about how the recent Hebrew Roots movement is. Because what I was explaining to you before is the Hebrew Roots movement. The recent Hebrew Roots movement is about, according to our detractors, about 200,000 strong, maybe up to 300,000. It's a lot of people. Herbert Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God reached 93,000 in its peak. 93,000 members in its peak. They're saying this is 200,000, 300,000. I don't know. I'm just looking at our detractors, the ones who write against us. And by the way, if you want to know what we are, go to the internet and you'll find out that we are certainly a cult. I mean, there's not a good thing about us. But there was days the same thing was said about Worldwide Church of God, right? And about all of us, okay? So, yeah, we're really bad. But that's what they're saying about us. But, you know, there's really no way to know how many of us there are. I'm going to back up here to slide 20, so forget I'm on this one right here. I guess I jumped because I didn't have anything written there. Okay, as far as I know, in recent history, there has been no major organization. And I'm talking now, I'm going to start shifting toward helping you understand what the modern Hebrew Roots is. As far as I know, there has been no major organization that has taught full obedience to the Torah since the time of the disciples. I think that the walk of Yeshua, the true following of Yeshua, didn't last an awful long time. That paganism got involved in it, and then there became a period, and I can't prove any of this. This is purely speculation, and I just want to let you know it is speculation. But I don't see any place where I have seen that there is a group of people who have said all the Torah is valid for us today. And I know that the Church of God did not believe all the Torah is valid for us today. I was a part of it for 25 years, and I do know. So, Worldwide Church God came close, but they made exceptions for a number of things. Number one, sacrifices. They said sacrifices were done away with. Sacrifices are part of Torah. Circumcision was done away with. Circumcision is part of Torah. Tzitzits were done away with. Tzitzits are part of Torah. But they classified these things as ceremonial, just as, or whatever, just as many other Protestant denominations did as well. But with the breakup of the Worldwide Church of God, something happened. There came an explosion in the Hebrew Roots movement. And we weren't a part of the Hebrew Roots movement when the explosion began, but we have seen it. Angie and I have hosted a Feast of Tabernacles site for 17 out of the last 18 years, maybe 9, I don't know, maybe one or two more. One time it got up to almost 1,000 people, right at 1,000 people. But at every feast site, I would ask people, raise your hands when God started calling you this way. And then I'd say, how many of you in 1990? And you have one or two. 91, one or two. 93, maybe five or six. 94. 95. 96. Hands just shot up. 1996 was a time, a special time, I think, in God's calendar. I think it was the time of the fullness of the Gentiles. whatever that means. Because 96 was when the Worldwide Church of God broke up. And in the Hebrew Roots movement, many of the movers and shakers in the Hebrew Roots movement used to be sitting in these seats. Maybe not here, but other cities around the world or something like that. They were there. As people came into the Hebrew Roots walk, they would come in thinking it was Jewish. Unless, like me, I knew it wasn't Jewish. I should have known better, but I knew. But I got involved in a few things. But people started to mature. And they started to see things differently. And they began to distance themselves from Judaism as they went on. One of the leading, I would call them leading persons to help people to understand that we can gain stuff from Judah, but we don't have to become Jews, was a guy named Dean Wheelock. And he's got a publication out called Hebrew Roots. He actually owns the, trademark, Hebrew Roots trademark. All right, so I'm going to move on to this slide right here. Oh, pushed the wrong button. Okay, it's 200,000 to 300,000 strong, so why don't we see them? Well, the reason we don't see them is because they're reluctant to come together. Most of the people in Hebrew Roots came out of the churches. Not out of these churches. They came out of the Baptist, Methodist. A large number came from the Assembly of God. A lot of Pentecostal. So this is where the people are coming. They're not coming necessarily out of the Worldwide Church of God. Most of the people in Hebrew Roots had never heard of Herbert Armstrong or any of the churches of God, really, unless someone else had mentioned it to them. They just started seeing things differently. His family right over here. They started seeing things differently. And over a period of time, they made contact with us. A lot of us like that. A lot of people like that in Hebrew Roots. But people like that, are people in Hebrew Roots, are generally reluctant to come together. They have a fear of the influence they might get by coming together. That they don't want to submit to another man. They don't want to take and be taught things wrong. They're afraid of being taught things wrong. And so they basically stay to themselves. And that's good and bad. It's bad in that people go off in crazy tangents if they don't have iron sharpening iron. And so this can become a problem. There is no leaders in Hebrew Roots other than maybe small local congregational leaders. There's no organization in Hebrew Roots, but there's a number of good teachers. Again, Dean Wheelock, Joseph Good is the guy who's credited with basically bringing a bunch of foundational information to help us to understand the New Testament first century church and first century church customs. Eddie Chumney, Brad Scott, Bill Cloud, all of these guys, they're making an impact on the world. And I'm not saying we're there yet, but I think eventually we're going to turn the world upside down, just as the disciples did. Okay, so what do we believe and teach? I'm going to have to go through this fast because I see... Remember, Kelly, I started late. Okay. All right. So let's go through some of the beliefs of the Hebrew Roots. We believe that the Bible is a Hebraic book. It's full of Hebrew idioms, Hebrew practices, and Hebrew thought. We believe, for the most part, and there is no statement of beliefs in Hebrew Roots because they become obsolete almost weekly. Because we're growing, we're learning, we're realizing what we thought yesterday was right on is not really right on because someone else brought it up. That's why we ask questions. That's why in any time, if you ever go to a meeting or anything that I organize, the speakers will always take questions. And so sometimes that one question you get, and it's happened to me a number of times, that one question from out in the audience blows the whole theme away of what I was presenting that day. And you just have to stick your tail between your legs and say, hey, I was wrong. It's hard for people to say that, but sometimes you're just plain wrong. And so I've been wrong before, And so I try harder the next time. Okay, Old Testament is the dictionary of the New Testament. I fully support this view. You cannot, and I'm just going to say it. I know people don't like it when I do. You cannot really truly understand the New Testament if you don't understand the Old Testament. Because the Old Testament is the dictionary. It defines the terms of the New Testament. There are no dispensations in Hebrew roots. It's one continuous story. The church is Israel, and God is restoring Israel to its calling. There is no spiritual Israel, and there is no replacement theology. The church did not replace Israel. God is still working with Israel. Go find me a place in the Old Testament, or the New for that matter, where God says, I'm through with you, Israel. I'm going to start over with someone new. He just doesn't do it. You know why? Because he's betrothed to Israel. The church is a fulfillment in part of the prophecies of return. And when I say the church, I'm not just talking about this church or any of the churches of God. The Baptists are part of this as well. The Catholics are part of this as well. Because they're all teaching about the Messiah. Now, we've all got something to learn. But we're all teaching about the Messiah. Not everybody has all the information, but everybody has a little bit, even the Catholics. Yeshua is the Messiah. We firmly believe Yeshua is Messiah. Just get on my website and see. I've been told oftentimes that in this area people think that Tim and Angie don't believe that Jesus is Messiah. That's the furthest thing from the truth. Yeshua is the Messiah. He is the topic. He is in the volume of the book. His message is the restoration of the kingdom. That means the kingdom has been here before. The disciples asked Yeshua before he was taken to his father, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Yeshua's answer was not. You guys got it crazy. What do you mean restore? He just says, it's not at this time. We believe that we are saved by grace for the purpose of keeping the Torah. And that all of the Torah is still in effect. Okay, I got just a couple of more things here. In regards to the Torah, I just want to explain something real quickly about the Torah. The Torah is instructions. It's not law. It's unfortunate that it's translated as law in most of our Bibles, but it's the Hebrew word actually means instructions. It's from the Hebrew word yara, Strong's 384, and it means to throw or to shoot. In other words, it means to hit a mark. Okay, so the Torah is all about hitting the mark. It's the instructions on how to get that arrow to hit that mark. And so you've got a trainer over here or a coach, and he's teaching you how to hold that bow to get that thing to hit the mark. That's what the Torah is all about. It's about hitting the mark. Of course, for us, the mark is pleasing God. How do we please God? And another thing about the Torah is not all Torah applies to all people. Why is that? Well, how many of us are transgender in here? Nobody got that? Okay. Then if you're not transgender, you can't do the Torah that applies to women and the Torah that applies to men, can you? All right? Because part of the Torah applies to women and women only. Part of the Torah applies to men and men only. Part of the Torah applies to the priesthood and the priesthood only. And so we believe that you keep Torah as much as you can based on what the Torah applies to. So we get a number of questions about when we say, you know, that we keep the Torah. Well, do you kill your kids? You know, do you stone your kids? Well, no, we don't stone our kids because we can't in this country. You can't. You just simply can't do it in this country. You would be thrown in prison for stoning your children. So, no, you don't do stuff like that. It's crazy. All right, some of the common beliefs are based on Deuteronomy 32. Take to heart all the words by which I am warning you. All the words by which I am warning you today that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. Not some of the words of this law, all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And by this word you shall live long in the land that you are going over to possess. So you cannot add to or take from the law. When God says you do all the words of the law, it means all the words of the law, not some of them. We cannot take and compartmentalize the Torah and say, well, this is ceremonial, so we don't do this. This is civil, so we don't do this. This is that, and that, and so we're not going to do them based on our classifications, because the Torah is not classified. It's all one book. Deuteronomy 12:32 says, you may not add to or take away from the Torah. Neither can James, neither can Paul, neither can Yeshua. Because if Yeshua were to take from the law, change the law, add to the law, or anything like that, he would be violating the Torah. So he can't do it. And why is that so? Because Yahweh does not change. He simply does not change. Okay, so what have I got next here? I did not change, therefore you, O Jacob, are not consumed. I'm just a little quickly thinking about Halakha. One thing about Torah, though, and this is where I think we've got it wrong sometimes. We believe that our Torah has to apply to you. Israel was a patriarchal society. And in Hebrew thought, the father or the leader of the clan decides what's the walk going to be. The word for a walk in Hebrew is halak. And they call it halakha. Halakha is simply how you apply the Torah. So you take it, you read the Torah, it says, you shall honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, but it doesn't tell you how to honor the Sabbath. So you have to decide what that means for your family, and what your family decides may not be what your family decides. Because all halakha is local. The leader of the family or the clan determines how the walk should be. But we're all told to do what? Work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. All right, I got just two more little quick things here. So to summarize, Hebrew Roots is an awakening. It's not rooted in any organization, but in the Hebrew Bible. You know, we talk about the Talmud sometimes. You know, every church has a Talmud. Talmud is nothing but opinions. And when you take and write down something about a scripture, you're writing an opinion. So all these publications out here that have articles written where they're trying to explain different beliefs, different scriptures, they're all Talmud, because Talmud means teachings. And so everybody writes their own, every church has their own Talmud. Hebrew Roots is not Judaism, it is Hebrewism. And that God's people will follow the example of the Hebrew of Hebrews, Messiah Yeshua. They will walk as he walked. And together we are actually fulfilling the prophets of return. We are not doing something new. We are simply doing something true. We're trying to follow the Torah, the Bible, exactly the way it says. And so I want to finish with this. Paul was standing before Felix one time, and he was being charged by the Pharisees who were out to get him. And he says, by this I confess to you that according to the way which you call a sect, cult, whatever you want to say, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. Paul says he believed that, he said that I'm doing everything that's written in the law and the prophets. I submit to you, we should too. So with that, my fonts didn't work there. It says, Shalom Aleichem, peace be unto you.